It's Wednesday, February 6, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, an Israeli firm claimed it's a year away from a complete cure for breast cancer. Word of the discovery made it around the world, only the promise may not quite be living up to the hype. President Trump is riding high the day after his State of the Union address. We'll talk about that. And I want to talk to Mike and Ernest about a meeting he had last week with the publisher of the New York Times. And the coverage of the sanctions the NCAA levied against the University of Missouri's football, baseball, and softball programs. And there's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our time's up today. But let's start in Virginia, where Friday night, Governor Ralph Northam apologized for a photo published on his page in his medical school yearbook that showed a picture of two people, one in blackface and one wearing a KKK robe. The calls for Northam to resign were, and still are, loud from Republicans and Democrats. Saturday afternoon, the cable news networks waited with bated breath after he called a news conference. In his statement, he said this.
When my staff showed me the photo in question yesterday, I was seeing it for the first time. I did not purchase the EVMS yearbook, and I was unaware of what was on my page. When I was confronted with the images yesterday, I was appalled that they appeared on my page, but I believe then and now that I am not either of the people in that photo.
So overnight, from Friday into Saturday, he went from apologizing to firmly denying that was him in the photo. And as they say, but wait, there's more. Because Northam took questions at that availability, talking to reporters for the better part of 45 minutes. And things took a bit of a turn when this question was asked.
Governor, you said at the San Antonio party, you darkened your face. I just want to be perfect.
Yes.
Were you in blackface?
I wasn't. I'll tell you exactly what I did, Alan. I dressed up in a, what's his name? Michael Jackson, excuse me. That's why I had Pam with me. I had the shoes, I had a glove, and I used just a little bit of shoe polish to put under my, or on my cheeks. And the reason I used a very little bit is because I don't know if anybody's ever tried that, but you cannot get shoe polish off. But it was a dance contest. I had always liked Michael Jackson. I actually won the contest because I had learned how to do the moonwalk.
I was watching this live. It was beyond. And the first commentator on MSNBC that they went to when this ended was Al Sharpton, and his head literally exploded on the air.
Well, you know, I followed this a little bit. Because it just seems like every week is something. You know, every week something is coming out of someone's past, and so here's another incident. But you know, to me, it's one of those things where, you know, you're looking at this, and if I remember correctly, this was in the 1980s?
84, I believe.
Okay.
It was.
When has it ever been good for a white person to dress up like a black person and put on blackface? It's just, in 1984, it was bad. It's bad today. It'll be bad tomorrow. If this is you, you apologize, you do whatever you have to do. And I think he's trying to do that, but because there is no second chances nowadays, I mean, he's going to be pushed and pushed and pushed until he has to resign.
Well, we should say we are recording this at 11 o'clock on Wednesday morning, that there has already been another instance, maybe in the last half hour or so, of the attorney general from the state of Virginia saying that there are images of him that exist as well of appearing in blackface. So by the time this actually runs on KBIA at 6:30, this entire situation may have changed. One of the things that struck me, and this is the part that made Al Sharpton's head explode, was this constant denial that was him in the photo, and he knows it's not him in the photo, because he's been in blackface at other times.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how he's able to know what he looks like in blackface. Well, but it was because the shoe polish wouldn't come off. It was mind-boggling.
I mean, yeah, you admitted that you know, this may not be me, but I've done it before. And it's like, wait a minute. You know, how is this good in any context?
Watching it live felt like the most bizarre televised news event I had seen since Justice Kavanaugh drank beer.
Yeah, you can win a dance contest dancing like Michael Jackson without putting on shoe polish. I'm just making a point.
Well,
he didn't remember who Michael Jackson was. He had needed his wife, Pam, to remind him who the musical artist was he was impersonating.
Yeah. Not only did he need his wife, Pam, to remind him of that, but when he almost looked like he was going to do the moonwalk during the news conference, she said, inappropriate time to be doing that. But you also had him doing all of this news conference stuff after he initially came out and basically acknowledged that it was him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And this whole thing in Virginia now is a cluster because you had the lieutenant governor, an African-American, who was supposed to be the next in line, being accused.
Who is elected independently. They don't run on a ticket.
Right. And he's been accused of sexual harassment, although that story is one that some news organizations chose not to run because it couldn't be verified. The accuser wouldn't come forward and talk about it. And now you've got the attorney general, who's third in line, who's said, I wore blackface at a college party. And all of this started because a little news outlet that was owned by a former Breitbart reporter got a photo from a concerned classmate, was the way they described it. Mm. And really, that story didn't tell you anything more than here's the picture from the yearbook, and this the whole snowball is gone from there.
And you're right. It is a snowball. But I mean, this goes back to things that we've talked about pretty much every week, is that your past will catch up with you. And in this polarized, partisan, and vindictive political environment that we have right now, if there is anything in your past that somebody can dig up to use against you, they're going to do it. And this is happening whether you're a Democrat or Republican. It doesn't really matter.
So is this one of those cases of things that reporters should have been able to dig up or look for or think about ahead of the election? Or is this one that is so obscure that nobody would think to go through every single, say, yearbook of somebody's educational past?
Well, but here's the issue here. The reporters are looking at what was the person's policies. Mm-hmm. What has the person done in their political life? Now, you know, it's almost like, you know, there's so much that you can look at. Are you going to go back and look for these kinds of little bitty things when we as journalists are supposed to be concentrating on what is this person going to do if they are in this office? What in their past can show us or demonstrate to the public, you know, what they're going to do in terms of policy and procedures and that sort of, and governing and that sort of thing. And now the reporters are going to have to go back and do these kinds of things as well. So they're playing catch up because, you know, that's just the environment we're in.
Well, and honestly, in the past, it's most likely that a concerned citizen or an opposition researcher would have come across this and then fed it to a reporter at an established traditional news organization. They would have done the proper reporting around this story, and then it would have come out and the consequences would have been whatever they were. In this instance, not unlike what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, the information is leaked to partisans, and then it gets onto social media, and then the traditional media are playing catch up after the fact, and that story's already had a life of its own before it's been evaluated.
And it's hard to pull the context back into that story once, you know, the information is out there on social media and people have been able to create their own narratives around it, and now that becomes the context, and it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle at that point.
It's interesting that last night during the State of the Union, President Trump couldn't help but
get his
jump on Northam, although not about the blackface, about something else.
Well, so talking about the State of the Union, thoughts, impressions, did you end up watching it live or have you really just been following the coverage?
I did. I watched it live. I also watched a little bit of the lead-up coverage on cable, jumped around some, and some of the coverage after, including the Democratic response. And, you know, it was kind of pure teleprompter Trump, but it was still Trump. I mean, he had a mixture of early on all of these attempts to seem to want to cooperate with Democrats. And then he came out with all the red meat, whether it was about abortion or stoking fears about immigration or throwing out his one-liner about, you know, you can't have, you know,
cooperation and investigation.
So it was pretty much pure Trump, even though he was, you know, reading it off a teleprompter.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch it live. I watched the excerpts of it and I read a lot of the coverage. And if you go and you read a lot of the coverage, mm-hmm. I mean, most of it is pretty much what Mike was talking about. I mean, the other thing that I would say that the coverage is starting to say is that he is trying to set things up for 2020 and say, here's some of the things that I've done. Here's some of the things that I hope to do in the next couple of years that I still have left, and hopefully, you know, be reelected. The wall is still something that I promised, and I'm going to build. I'm going to protect the country from the evil hordes trying to get into the country. You know, all of the red meat things that he talks about. But I mean, I think he's still a little. He's definitely worried about the investigations, because you're right about that line. Yeah. He put that line in there to basically say, to let the American public know, we are about to enter this era of investigation and after investigation.
And a little bit, too, of kind of that underlying threat of either you drop this mm-hmm. or nothing that you want
there
to get through.
There will be no cooperation.
There will be none. And, you know, as we have this looming threat again of another government shutdown next week. It felt like a not so veiled threat to the Democrats.
I think it was. I also think another really interesting aspect of that was all of the counter programming and symbolism that was going on before, after, and during the State of the Union speech.
The white pantsuits for the
women elected to Congress. You had, you know, the guests, the dueling guests, yes. The president's guests, the member of Congress and their guests. You had people Facebook living presidential candidates, Facebook living before and after it. You had the cameras, whoever was running the pool camera knew to focus in on those Cory Booker, Kamala Harris or yes. You know, any of those other candidates every time something would be said that might relate to them. Right. You had Speaker Pelosi back there, who I think was very careful in the way she was doing her kind of little mini clap looking like she was reading his speech, like, I can't believe he's saying this.
And there were even some moments where it looked like perhaps she was signaling the Democrats as to when to respond and when not to. There were some somewhat awkward moments in there as well. Mm-hmm. The comment about women being having more opportunities in the workforce than ever before, and the Democrats all standing, the women standing up to applaud themselves. It was like this backfire moment, or the moment when everybody started singing happy birthday and he starts directing the crowd.
I mean, it was a lot of theatrics going on. What I haven't read yet, and I'm sure it's out there, is just how engaged the American public is. I mean, there have been stories after States of the Union going back to Clinton and even further, that as we've moved into this more polarized and partisan political environment, people are checking out on mm-hmm. State of the Union. They're finding other things. I mean, there's so much. You know, you can stream things. You can do other things. You can just check out of it entirely, and if you want to engage, you can engage on at your own time, in your own way, and not have to sit there and go through the...
I think that's part of the evolution of the cable news network.
No, absolutely.
C-SPAN as well,
absolutely.
Is that, yes, the networks still give the president the time to do that, but it becomes 1 hour, or the length of the address, and that's it.
And remember this, I mean, this was what, how many weeks has it been since it was supposed to happen?
Right.
You know, because of the shutdown? And at the time, people were going like, oh, okay, well, we're not going to have it this year. Great. Well, let's move on and do something
Bring
else.
Bring This Is Us back on Tuesday night.
Well, and in a related vein, I mean, Stacey Abrams, you know, who didn't win the governorship of Georgia by just a tiny little bit, gave the Democratic response, and media were sort of fawning over her, saying, well, you know, she did great. I mean, she wasn't Marco Rubio in the water bottle, or she wasn't Bobby Jindal, you know. Some Republicans who've really screwed up giving that response. But on the other hand, how many people were actually watching that besides journalists? I don't know.
Right, absolutely. And what she talked about mm-hmm. was really important, which mm-hmm. was voter suppression. And I mean, there were clear instances in the midterm elections across the country where voters were...
You mean her own election?
Her own election, elections in Florida. I mean, there are elections all over the place where either votes were suppressed before the election, during the election, and after the election. I mean, things are in place right now to make it much more difficult for people to vote. And then you had last week where Mitch McConnell basically came out and said, you know, that having a day off for everyone to actually go to the election would be a Democratic power grab. And now you have people saying, whoa, wait a minute. Having that actually gives people the opportunity to exercise the franchise. How could you say that that's a power grab by one party over another? I mean, that's a real issue that needs to be addressed.
Okay, well, Friday the president paid a visit to New York Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger, and the two talked for a while about a lot of things, including the president's continued anti-press rhetoric and claims of fake news. This was one of those discussions that really gave some insight into the president's bubble, kind of where he's living in and how he's perceiving things.
Yeah, and by the way, props to the New York Times for not giving in to the first request, because the president wanted to have a private meeting with the publisher. The publisher says, no, I think I'm going to have Maggie Haberman and Peter Baker come in and be there, and it's going to be an on-the-record encounter. And, you know, what he said is kind of, again, pretty typical. Well, the same time that he thinks he is or wants to be a great defender of the free press, and there are some media that are not fake news. And then he went on to rail about fake news and how any story basically that was bad about him, you'd expect him to call it fake news. So it was pretty typical presentation there.
Yeah, if you read through it, it's sort of like he's giving these, when it was a question that he didn't necessarily agree with, he'd give a one-word answer. Or if he was trying to defend what he calls fake news, which he basically said, I created.
Right. He had lots of pride in the idea of coining that term, but again, not understanding the impact of those words and how he has used them, not only here in the United States, but is it's related to free press issues and the ability to exercise a free press around the globe.
He wouldn't accept that he had that impact or that it was his fault.
No, he flat out said, well, I don't know if that's right, or, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, I will say this. He is the recipient of decades of work on behalf that's been done by partisans to craft this narrative that the media is against conservatives and that sort of thing. But he was able to sort of galvanize all of that into two words, fake news, and use it as a weapon against independent media. And that's and the New York Times calling him on that in that meeting, I think, was a very good thing in putting it out there.
We've gone out on a limb a couple of times on this program where we've talked about how this war between Trump and the media, that perhaps the journalists aren't exactly innocent in this, and that we're spending so much time stomping our feet talking about how we can't get a fair shake because of what he's doing or what he's saying. How did the New York Times' handling of this either kind of help the cause of journalism or perhaps set it back again?
I don't know that it made any real difference, honestly. I mean, I think that the fact that they made it an open, on-the-record conversation was good, so that anything said about it was sort of in the context of a typical news story. But is it going to move the needle one way or the other? I'd be really surprised.
So it may be comparing apples and oranges, but juxtapose that to the Washington Post Super Bowl commercial from the other night that was narrated by Tom Hanks. I know some of my students were criticizing it because they felt like they were watching something that was basically saying journalists are good, support journalists, but weren't necessarily getting any kind of message about how to do that or how to evaluate information out of that commercial.
Well, you're not going to get that out of a minute commercial. I think you're asking for a lot if you're hoping to get all of that out of that. I did see that commercial. I thought it was pretty well done, and I think the Washington Post was basically sending a message that, you know, and their message is, this is the type of journalism that we're going to do. We feel like this stands up for democracy, and we're sending a message not only to the public, but also to those who think that we aren't doing that, that this is what we're going to do.
You know, Amy, I noticed the same generational situation that you did. I was impressed by it. I thought it was forceful, mm-hmm. but it was apolitical. It was very well done. But then I asked my students in my capstone class about it, and the general reaction was they spent $10 million at a time when journalists are losing their jobs, when the industry is imploding. They could have used their money for something better. Yeah. And that just tells you something that's about the fragile nature of the business that they're about ready to go into, mm-hmm. that would be their initial reaction to it.
Okay, so this one, it's hard to tell what it is. Is it junk science or some desperate entrepreneurs looking to find funding quickly? This clip from a television station in Australia, it shows a story that you probably saw some reporting that looked a little bit like it on a TV broadcast or radio broadcast here in the United States or online.
Scientists in Israel claim they'll have a complete cure for cancer by next year. The treatment, called multi-target toxin, uses a combination of peptides and a toxin to kill cancer cells.
When I heard about it, I thought, look, it just does sound way too good to be true, but it is working apparently quite well in the petri dish with human cancer cells and in mice.
It's hoped clinical trials on people could start within the next year.
So, a version of that story or something like it, it ran far and wide all the world over last week. Reported somewhat less widely day or two later was how unlikely this actually is to happen, in part because, well, there wasn't a whole lot from scientists. There wasn't a whole lot from business analysts in the original reporting. And what we find out day or two or 3 days later is that this is an Israeli company that's kind of on the brink of collapse and trying to get some word out there.
This is a case study in like the worst of every possible way you could report a science or medical story. First, the original piece in the Jerusalem Post, it had two sources total, and they were both from the company that claimed to be on the verge of doing this. Second, there were no human trials. There was no published research, and any good science journalist would have discovered that right away, would have gone to other researchers to ask them for their impressions about it. The other thing about the story that was obviously—
Or even doctors, if not researchers.
You could tell the reporter in the Jerusalem Post was just taking at face value all this gobbledygook coming out of the mouths of these researchers and didn't show any knowledge about how to convey that in lay terms to a general audience, probably didn't even understand independently what was being claimed there.
Yeah, I mean, when I looked at this, that all of what you just said jumped out at me, especially the fact that, you know, they didn't go and do the thorough report. I mean, if you're going to make a claim as huge as this that has an impact globally and not do the thorough checking, and for the Jerusalem Post, which is a pretty reputable
paper,
to run this based on this kind of flimsy evidence is just— You know, this would be one of those crimes against journalism. Mm-hmm. This would be one of them.
If you want to see a good version of how this story was reported, you've got it on our links blog to a piece in Forbes by a person who's a cancer researcher herself, as well as a science communicator. It's a great piece. But the problem is that once established journalists started asking questions, again, it was a social media meme.
Yeah.
Cure was out there, and no amount of real reporting was going to pull that back.
And because people want to hear that there's a cure for cancer. There's going to be nothing catchier.
And this is one of the things. This is one of the downsides to social media. When you have the ability to put a story out there and let it run and create its own narrative, and then journalists are playing catch up, and by the time they catch up and be able to actually put some facts behind it,
toothpaste is not going back in the tube. Okay, so we didn't get to this story last week. And Ernest, you were disappointed that we had ran out of time before we had a chance to talk about it. So I promised we'd get it in today. The museum in Washington, D.C. has announced that it's likely to close at the end of the year, that Johns Hopkins University has bought its building and is going to house some of the university's graduate programs that are kicking out the museum. In the decade or so that it's been there, it's been a great resource for teaching media literacy, but in so many ways, it's an institution that's kind of been doomed from the start.
Yeah, there's so many problems, and I think you have several stories on it in the Links blog that sort of spells it out, but ultimately what it boils down to is that they had a great idea. I think they overreached, moving from where it was originally was in Roslyn, Virginia, to the uh, to to where it is now and about to be sold, mm-hmm. which is where most of the museums are in D.C. That they bought that property way overpriced when they purchased it. It cost them a heck of a lot of money to build that building, and they just didn't have the financial capital to do it, and they couldn't get buy-in from other philanthropies and other people to sort of help them to establish an endowment that would have made it plausible. And I think it's something that's going to be sorely missed, not just for journalism, but for the country as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be or willing to be inspired and you go to the museum, you will be. I mean, there are some exhibits there that really are truly inspiring, but it did cost too much money. I just hope they'll find some way, online, traveling exhibits or some things that they've talked about, that they'll keep some of those programs alive, even if they don't have a physical space for it to reside.
Well, they have said that a lot of the online teaching materials that are there will stay online, at least for a long time to come. It seems all anyone around here is talking about is a decision that was handed down last Thursday from the NCAA, sanctions against the football, baseball, and softball teams due to an academic code violation. The coverage of this has been extensive, in part because of how the accusations came to light, and even more so because of the level of cooperation that Mizzou demonstrated throughout the process. I should disclose that I am currently working with a large number of students, many of them on the teams that are affected by this decision, but my connection with MU Athletics didn't come into play until well after some of this alleged activity was over. Still, as I read the stories and the columns, the one theme I saw over and over again, and not just from local or regional publications, is that this action was taken against Mizzou because it chose to cooperate.
Yeah, and that's a problem. That is a huge problem for the NCAA, because basically the message that they're sending out is that if you cooperate, you're going to get even tougher sanctions against you than if you don't. I mean, and that goes back to UNC, that the University of North Carolina, where they had years of issues involving students and academic fraud. The same thing, you had Louisville, which was dealing with issues of boosters paying for dancers, mm-hmm. or students to be escorts for potential athletes. Neither of those programs cooperated with the NCAA, and their sanctions were far less than what happened to Missouri in this case. And that is why you've seen so much pushback, not only by the university itself, but by alums and other universities, which are basically saying this is a huge overreach by the NCAA.
One can't help wonder whether the NCAA has a set of standards for the really big revenue-generating schools and the ones that are less so, and whether, again, if you cooperate, you know, you get punished, and if you don't cooperate, you get to skate. There also is some questions about the tutor. I mean, her primary allegation that she was encouraged by athletic department administrators to cheat for these athletes was not proven. The NCAA said that. And yet, despite the cooperation on the part of the university, they're getting the hammer. So, you know, I don't think, as you say, Amy, it wasn't just Homer media that were saying that either. Mm-hmm. National publications were saying the same thing.
Okay, well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today and a couple we didn't get to on our links blog. You can find that under the programs and the podcast tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.